You're Swiss, right, Matt?
Yes, I'm from
You're
Switzerland.
free,
Yeah,
Matt?
yeah.
And
I'm
where are you from, Gav?
half Italian and half French.
Okay, cool. All right, I'll try. Yeah, you guys will understand me. I've only got one language and half brain, so you got huge advantage.
Welcome to the 23rd episode of our podcast Up on Foil, where we talk all about foiling. And today we're here with Richard Botton. Rich lives in South Devon in England. He has a kite repair shop and repaired kites and wings for the last 15 years. Kitebarn.co.uk did retail. He was called the godfather of UK winging, and he's the technical editor of the foiling magazine. Sorry. He said that timing-wise, it's normally best in the mornings after a coffee. So, Rich, thank you for coming on the show. Did you have your coffee yet?
Yeah, got my coffee on the go here. I've completed the school run, so all my jobs are done for the morning now, and I could talk to you guys.
Perfect, perfect. That is awesome. Thank you very much for coming on the show. You're a foiler, a kiter. Maybe you can just introduce yourself and tell us how you get into water sports and on foil eventually.
Wow. I started kite surfing in probably 2004. I went to university near the coast, down in the south, east of the UK, in Kent. And, you know, I just saw kite surfing. And I wasn't really, you know, I'd done like a bit of motocross and stuff like that before, but I've not really done much, you know, like extreme sports stuff before. So, yeah, I just saw it and I thought that looks interesting, and then started doing it, really. I spent my student loan money on some really terrible equipment, some, you know, like an old North Rhino 2 or something like that. And then I just started doing it, really. And then that rolled into a career in kite surfing, I'd say, in the loosest possible way. So I finished my degree. I worked in like IT consultancy, sort of animation stuff for about 18 months. And then I realized how bored I was going to be doing that long term, and I'd probably end up 150 kilos sat at a computer. So I had a girlfriend at the time that was working in Kenya, and she said there's a job as a kite instructor going. So I ended up going out to Kenya. Sort of left my job, went to Kenya, and then that was before you could even get a qualification, maybe. So it was quite early. And then I came back from Kenya in like 2007, did my instructor qualification, and then met my wife and on the instructor's course. And that's Sarah, who now edits Kite Surf magazine. So yeah, that's your, yeah, like Kite Mag. So yeah, we ended up sort of 2007 to 2010 just traveling and instructing. So like Australia, Brazil, South Africa, all the big spots. We did
six months
in Cape Verde. Yeah, yeah. It's all worked out well in the end, but with a lot of risk in the way, I'd say. So yeah, we did the sort of kite instructing. Then we came back. Then we imported a small kite brand because we got fairly good at that point. And my wife was competing as well. Sarah was competing. So we imported a small kite brand for a while. And then I realized very quickly I needed to be able to repair things because there was warranty stuff going on.
So you repaired for the things you sold, not your own gear?
Yeah, mainly. But that's what prompted it. I felt a kind of responsibility that if I was selling something, I should be able to offer good after-sales service. And through instructing and seeing, you know, how equipment degrades under pressure, it was just something I felt compelled to do. Kind of taught myself that. One of my friends had already run a kite repair shop for a couple of years, so he taught me a little bit. And that became, the kind of primary income, if you like, was the kite repair. There's only like four of us that do it in the UK. We all communicate quite well. We're all quite good, you know, we're good friends, but we're all on good terms. So, it's a very specific thing to do. Accidentally, that was quite successful. And through that, you end up interacting with the brands to source spares and, you know, like mop up, warranty problems and things, you know, things that are breaking, and helping out the end consumer for them because they always can't. So that ended up leading to retail, because all of a sudden you've got B2B access to get spares. And where I am in the Southwest is very remote. but there's quite a big population of kite surfers, well, and foilers now here. So yeah, it was fairly successful. It's been good. And then
how was your transition
foiling
from, surfing?
All right. So kite surfing was it's like a big part of it all. So what happened first? I think it was the slingshot. The slingshot guys gave me one of those early foils. So 2015-ish, maybe. Big spade-shaped thing. And because I'd done so much kite surfing at that point, I felt quite kind of saturated. I was almost getting a bit bored of it. The only buzz I'd really get from it was pushing myself into really big waves here. And I was kind of really plateaued ability-wise. So it fed in at a really good point with me, where I was kind of bored of everything else. So yeah, I went really nuts on kite foiling for a bit, which was good. Quite early doors, kind of as soon as there was production equipment. And that timed as well with me starting to do the magazine work. So at that point, I ended up speaking to Alex, who's running Kite Mag at the time. And he wanted someone to do product reviews. So I just started writing product reviews. That then built into the ultimate test. So that was like quite a big operation where we'd basically go around all the manufacturers, get a huge amount of equipment, take it to Dapler and test it with a big team for the week. So that was kind of my idea. I helped kind of establish and found that. And we did that for 2 or 3 years. And then the pandemic kind of killed it. And then foiling kind of took all the marketing budget. So then we shifted into a foiling magazine as well, which we started in 2019.
That was so 5.5 years ago, right? More or less.
Yeah. It was quite a while back. So I did my ACL in, I don't know when it was, maybe 2014 as well. Maybe it was 2013. I think I did my ACL in 2013. And then obviously I had sort of 6 months off the water. Then my rehab was meant to be lots of wobble board stuff. Physiotherapy. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I mean, I'd never really been interested in SEP. And then I started SEP because at least I could be on the water. There was no impact. And it was like wobble board. So it built my knee up really nicely. And then that progressed into SUP foil, but very early doors. So like 2017-ish with homemade equipment.
Yeah, you must have been one of the first ones there.
Yeah, like stick on foil boxes with 3M tape and stuff like that on normal SUPs. And we actually, the first one me and my friend made down here was it was based on the Levitas kite system. So we were like, what's the strongest foil we can find? And it was at that point, it was the Levitas one by some stretch. So then we built a new front wing for it, which was maybe 1200, 1300, pulled it behind a boat, tested it. That was before surf foils were even a thing. So yeah, it's quite good. I'm just gonna have a bit of water. I'm gonna have a drink.
Sure. Go ahead. You're talking.
I'm on the monologue now.
Yeah, that's super interesting because I tried to find things out about you, and it's really hard to get to know you as a person. We see what you do, but you as a person are not really online. Is that on purpose?
No. No, yeah, it is. I've only really come out of my shell in an online context in the last year or so. I'm quite private, I guess. I don't know if I'm an introvert or not. You could probably analyze that for quite a while.
I said it. But how was like your experience, like the emotions that you experienced on foil the first time you tried this slingshot spaceship type of foil?
It was great. It was quite hard then. The equipment was pretty terrible. It was really heavy. You know what? Actually, before that, I tried kite foiling in 2009 on a Carafino. So the proper OG aluminium one. And that was like 20, 25 kilos. That was a lump. Yeah. That was for maybe 1 hour. And I got going in one direction and then had to kind of swim back. So I got going on my good tack. It was sort of offshore wind down here. But yeah, that was what it definitely wasn't viable, I'd say. as a mass market product. But that felt terrible. But then the Slingshot one was much lighter, although it was aluminium. And you got that first gliding sensation. Straight away, I knew this is going to be a thing. And it was the same with SUP foil as well. First couple of times I did that, you know, it's quite hard to line everything up and get going. Even like, we have really good conditions for it here. But that first,
I can imagine it's also
sessions,
difficult because you said, well, you were one of the first. Now I'm trying to SUP foil. I see it is possible because it's all over my Instagram. But you, as one of the first ones, were you sure that it will eventually happen, that you're able to do that? Or just like, I'm not sure yet if it's possible.
We'd seen Kai Lenny do it. And I was just like, the waves here are perfect. So we've got this big kind of V-shaped bay that's, you know, like a kilometer down the road. And it basically is an underwhelming surf spot. So most of the time, occasionally it will fully barrel when it's incredible. But the majority of the time, particularly over the high tide, it's like this little spaced out rumbly wave. It's doing it like right now. I'll send you a screenshot afterwards for context. SUPing is always a bit, you know, it's pretty crap most of the time. So I thought if I can get the Kai Lenny lift and then go, it would feel incredible. So it's a bit of a risk, and I like tinkering around with things. I like making stuff. Me and my friend, he built a 40-foot catamaran from scratch in a barn, so he's pretty good with composites. He helped me put it together and bolt it all on, and then it kind of worked. And you get these little glimpses of it working, but I didn't really know that would turn into a magazine and like where we are now with it is just crazy. So I've seen the full genesis of it, and I think social media has had a lot to do with how quickly it's proliferated, I'd say. Because everyone knows what everyone's doing all the time. So if you look at like kite surfing's lifespan was long, it still is long, you know, it's 20 years. And it's kind of, it took a long time for it to level out. Whereas with foiling, I think we've started to almost level and homogenize 5 years in because everyone knows what's going on the whole time. It's crazy.
How did you see this world changing?
Yeah, obviously to start with, it was SUP. Then prone fed in. So there was guys proning down here like 2019. So to start with, it was just me really on the surf foil. Starboard came in really early with boards with foil boxes in. And the starboard distribution is quite close to here. So that's the first one I had was some sort of really terrible crossover surf foil. Like it was a hypernut, which is their kind of figure of eight shape thing. And the foil box was slightly at an angle, so you had to shim it like hell to make it work. And I think the first production surf foil I got was like one of those first Axis ones, maybe. They were very early because they had that kite range. And I guess that was like a 102 or something like that. And then it started to work like instantly. Like, you know, you could ride, you could cut back, and you could pump. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
That is nice. And now foiling obviously is all over the place. When you started that foiling magazine, we said like five and a half years ago, you started doing that with reviews. How did it evolve? How do you compare your first magazine with the actual ones? We're at number 22 right now, I think.
Yeah, like so to start with, it was a massive risk because it takes, particularly with, you know, like printed media. You know, you've got some outlet, you know, you've got some overheads to deal with. We found a guy, Kai, on the North Coast. And he's the kind of pivotal guy with it all. He assembles it all. And he's super organized, diligent, and thorough. So he kind of works, you know, he's the node that links everyone else, sort of all the scrappy guys on the beach, you know, doing the reviews and testing things and getting everything back. Issue one was like Kai Lenny on the cover.
It helps.
It was probably 150 pages or something. I don't know. It wasn't very thick. And then what we've had to do through those 5 years is try and predict the market trends, you know, with the help of the brands to augment it into whatever discipline is prevalent and include all these new disciplines, because it's split into so many disciplines. To start with, we were going to call it Surf Foil Magazine. Well, Alex wanted to. And I said no, because there's these e-foil things coming as well. And where do we fit kite foiling? And then there's SUP foiling. And it was funny because SUP foiling really was quite prolific at the start. And then it's kind of died a death until last year when downwindings come back. And now everyone wants the SUP foil, which is quite good for me because I've already got skill set, which had been kind of dormant for years. So that's kind of cool. But yeah, we've just had to kind of change as the industry has changed, as the disciplines have switched around, and accommodate everything. Because at the end of the day, you have to take advertising revenue to pay for the thing. But it's been really
nice. Is
that
hard to get these advertisers?
No, quite honestly. Because it works, like particularly for emerging brands, like they can put themselves alongside the main players. So I think so it makes them look a little bit bigger than they are, makes them a bit more established. And there's been certain, like Apple Tree, for example, they started off fairly small and now they're a fairly major player. And I think if you speak to Vigor or Mareka, the guys that do most of the running, they'll definitely say it's had a really positive effect for them. And it's also nice to champion brands that are doing something different. So for instance, they're manufacturing in Europe. They're trying to do it in the most kind of ecologically friendly way they can produce a board. So like, it's nice to push that. And I've had a lot of natural wetsuits. Obviously we had the Big Sea documentary last year, which really shook up the wetsuit industry. So that's kind of, I have loads of natural wetsuits this year, so that's really nice things to write about and try and do something positive rather than just sell beach toys.
What is your? I've seen that you have like 20, you have 10 people plus I don't know how many contributors on that magazine. What is your exact job? What does a technical editor do?
So I do product testing primarily. Well, no, actually, it's not primarily. It's alongside everything else. So the product testing is whatever is convenient to get to the UK, I deal with. Since Brexit, it's been difficult to get everything to the UK. And also, there's certain things that are not available. So the flight lab stuff, for instance, that's, hanging around in the background at the moment, they wanted to test that in Australia. So we need a guy in Australia. We need a guy in the UK. We've got, Rodri that tests in Tarifa. Steve Tobis on Maui. So we have all these people spread around. So it's kind of most convenient to get tests done for the manufacturer, because otherwise you're just shipping stuff around the world and that just creates loads of customs forms and payments. So that's no good. My role is, say we're going to interview someone, a designer. So I'll co-write the questions. So Kai will do a kind of framework of questions, and then I will go in there and put in the more awkward ones for the designers or the brand owner or something like that. So,
what do you mean, like provocative ones?
Well, yeah, generally I ask the more awkward questions, because you can do the nice kind of marketing led ones that lets them talk about their stuff. Yeah. And then you can be like, right, how did you actually manufacture this?
Yeah.
What is the real reason? Because I think, my head works better for that sort of thing than Kai. Kai is just really organized. So I'm the kind of, and if Kai has a technical query, he'll revert to me. So that's what I do really, is write awkward questions and some testing. And I also, I'd say I help guide where we should be going from a kind of market, how the industry is evolving perspective, because normally I'll see something ahead of when it becomes prevalent. Like foil dry, for instance, has been quite a big one in the last year or so. And I kind of saw that coming and I thought we need to talk to these guys because this is going to be massive. And yeah, that's been a really good relationship with them.
So you ask awkward questions. Are you also the one who finds stories, like in the actual magazine? You write about Steve and Simon's foil around Britain. Do people come to you and say, we have a story to tell? Or yeah. are you listening and see, like, I want to talk about this?
People come to us, I think, because we're, I think, because the magazine's printed and it's more curated, then I think at the moment we're kind of overwhelmed by online content. So people come to us because I think we can deliver it in a more kind of curated and organized way. Plus, we print it because I think as an online only magazine, it's difficult to differentiate yourself from all the other noise. If you know what I mean, we're just bombarded by information so much. So I think it's nice to be able to kind of curate. But generally people come to us with stories, and sometimes like we'll create our own. Done a few kind of local ones down here. But also if you notice something interesting happening that's not being promoted, you know, whether it has an advertising bias or not, I'll always kind of latch onto that. If there's something really cool happening, you just want to get it in there. Yeah, something unique. Like when we first started, I don't know what issue it was, maybe like within the first 5 issues, there was a 10-year-old kid down here prone foiling in, I can't remember what it was. It was probably before the pandemic. You know, it was really early doors. I just thought that is really unique. So we did this really nice photo shoot with him, wrote a little story. And he's now like national level surf competition. So yeah, stuff like that. So it's been really nice to help, you know, give friends and people that are doing cool stuff, like promotion.
What are your favorite stories, maybe next to the one that you just told us?
That's probably one of the favorites. There's been so many. Like, I'd literally have to flick through.
No, that's
yeah,
fine.
It's been five and a half years. I couldn't actually pick one off the top of my head. Yeah, I could come back to on that.
Maybe later. So your magazine comes out 4 times a year. How?
Yeah.
Maybe you can tell us how your stress level is going when one magazine is out and before the next one comes out. Or I can imagine you also have some stories that you're going to print in the next one and not just finish one and then start with the next one.
That's the thing with the printed side, is because information is now so readily available, people withhold stuff from releasing it online, or a set of pictures will be withheld and we'll have exclusive usage of it, but people have to sit on it and be quiet until it is printed, sort of thing. But stress levels wise, for me, it's not too bad because essentially I'm a consultant. I just go in and tweak things. I submit my, like, sometimes I get really bombarded with equipment for reviews. So it's like, shit, I've got to get 10 reviews out. The conditions don't quite line up. But normally I'm in a position with the like repairs and retail side where I can just go whenever the conditions are good, I will just go. So I always get it done, and I don't think I've ever kind of submitted anything I'm not comfortable with, which is quite lucky. I've always been pretty militant with that, like because I did a lot, you know, I've done this, there's been 5 years of foiling mag, but there's probably been a decade now at least of kite testing as well. And a lot of people will do 2 or 3 years and then burn out and then like not have anything novel to write about.
Do you still go on the water and just enjoy yourself?
Yeah, all the time, yeah. I bloody love it.
Because we talked to Gunnar Binjas in 2 episodes ago, and he said, like, usually when he goes on the water, it's work. It's testing. It's making videos, photos. It's just work. But for you, it's still
like
fun.
For me, it's still fun because, I don't know, I can just go out, ride, sit, you know, I don't have the pressure most of the time with video work. So all I've got to do is write something, and that's something I'm really efficient at. So I'm just storing information out there. I think about it. I keep it in the back of my head. I'll go back and then I'll do something like a menial task, like fix a kite or, you know, make a bridle for a fly surfer, something like this. I'll be doing something just manual. And then in my head, I was thinking, like, okay, how did it actually feel? So I have this, like, meditative time in between. And then normally in the morning, I'll get up, have a coffee, and then just, it'll be done. It's done. So, yeah, my process is pretty refined after 10 years, or so.
Mm-hmm.
When I was doing the ultimate test with the kite surfing, that was a big operation. So that would be taking 8 to 10 people to Dakle and a lot of kites. I think one of them, it was like 50 or 60 kites. It was a full fish truck full of kites to Dakhla.
Yeah, you need to organize yourself to see which one is which and not mess things up.
I'm going
to
ask like a silly question, like you say you ask it. Like, how many foils do you think you, or foils or like gear in general, you think you tried in these 5-6 years?
Oh, again, I'd have to look back for a proper figure, but I reckon I get through by like maybe 10 or 15 a year, something like that, foils. But even maybe just in manufacturers, there's maybe 8 or 10 that feed me stuff all the time. But then obviously there's a different front wings, different tails, some will send me a new mast.
For and a then wing, on the retail let's say wing, side, which like, one is your favorite? And are you allowed to say that?
Yeah, I can be pretty obvious. We like say so F1 don't actually advertise in the magazine at the moment. So, but I deal with them on the retail side. Foils, I flick between a lot of different foils, but the wings wise, I really like the F1 strike and the F1 swing. Particularly this year, like my riding style is very, very wave biased because of my location. And I started the year on the strike. And they kind of had the delays with the handles. So, you know, I quite like soft handles anyway because wave location and it's very gusty here. So a bit of suspension's a good thing right. Sometimes.
Yeah. Smoother ride.
Yeah, and also, like, if you get washed, there's less kind of hard stuff. I don't know.
Makes sense.
But in the end, when they released the handles, I ended up going with a solid front handle and then a hybrid rear handle. So there's a little bit of suspension, but then a little bit more control on the front. So it's like tweaking equipment. Yeah, but anyway, I really like the F1 strike. And then I can't remember what happened. I think it was just on demo with the shop for a lot. So then I ended up trying the swing in kind of more consequential wave conditions where you really needed to flag it. And I got on really, really well with that as well. It's very, very passive. It's probably not as dynamic around kind of upwind triangle. It's not quite as fast in a straight line, but that thing flags like a little ghost. It's brilliant. Like the 4.5 meter I've got on really well with.
Any types of foils?
Foils, I'm all over the place. So the ones I keep around because I think they're kind of industry benchmarks at the moment, particularly for wave stuff. So I've got a Code S series quiver. Like, so I think 720 through to the 1300. And I use that for SEP foil as well. That's just fabulously glided and turns really nicely. It's just a really well-balanced foil and it's a solid system. So I'm pretty heavy. So I'm like 185 centimeters, 90 kilos. So I'm a pretty solid guy. So I need like pretty stiff equipment or it doesn't work. Basically, I need big gear.
So you can really test that thing.
Yeah, oh yeah. No, and if it's going to bend, I'll bend it for sure. Because I've got big wave conditions. Like if something's going to snap, it'll snap with me.
Do things snap?
So yeah, occasionally. Yeah, things break. Not for a while. Like early doors, things were under-engineered or like they'd not quite got their heads around the connection systems and things, but not for a while, actually. I've not broken anything for ages. But yeah, anyway, back to foil. So the Code system, I think that's a bit of industry benchmark at the moment. Then I've got an Axis set. So I just had the Fireball through, which I really enjoyed as well. That was they've kind of gone in very niche directions, I think, Axis at the moment. So everything's very specific to task, and there's not really, like maybe the new Arc V2 I tested is the most all-roundy and most kind of level with the other ones that I haven't, maybe. I keep F1 Skate in a 750 and a 950, just because that's another one that's quite an old foil, that's been around for 2 years, but that still really holds up, I think, in terms of performance. It's a really good one for what I do. And then I've got an Armstrong set, all the HAs, the MAs. And again, that's quite interesting because the HA is very high lift, but it still seems to have like quite a good speed range. I really like that one. That's a really well-rounded foil. So basically the ones I keep are surf foils, sort of well-rounded. So I can sup and like wing on them.
Pump when around. You get things to test, you usually have to send them back, or do they send it to you and you could also keep it?
Well, I'm in a funny position because I do retail as well, because there's no one else that does retail down here really. So if I have an account with that brand, sometimes I'll absorb it into stock and just keep it as demo kit, and sometimes it goes back. So it's good for me just to have a few benchmarks around, because then when you test something, you can go back and say, oh, it felt a bit like skate, or it felt a bit like Kate, and you can go back and refer to it. So I've got the perfect excuse really to have way too much equipment, which is good.
Yeah.
And for it not to cost me too much. That's cool.
So you, in the magazine, write questions, you test gear. You also do online content.
Yeah, it's something me and Chris started last year. So I definitely think I work best in the written form. Like, some good friends of mine do a podcast, and I was very resistant even to go on that. I don't like, you know, this is new ground for me, putting myself out anywhere. I normally work in the shadows, let's say. Sorry, what did you ask me again?
What do you do? Digital content as well, online content.
Yeah. So we started doing the deep dive thing. So I was like, if I'm going to go on YouTube, I want to do it properly. And whenever I've done product testing before, I think you get the most rounded results if you have someone to bounce ideas off as well. If you've got someone to talk to, particularly someone like Chris, who's extremely experienced and a really good rider. And also Chris is a good friend, so it's a good excuse for us to go and meet up for the day, fly some drones, get some really nice conditions, and then we normally have Cornish pasty, and then afterwards we'll have a chat, and hopefully the pasty's not sent us to sleep. So yeah, that's the kind of format with that. And I didn't want it to be shit, was the if we're going to do it, we're going to do it properly. So yeah, we were pretty pleased with how that went, and the industry response, like the manufacturers really like it, and they can see results from what we're doing. And also we hope, you know, the primary focus was to make sure that we were giving proper consumer advice, so we really balanced the opinions on the equipment. So we will say some negative things, we will say what it's good and bad. Because I think there's this symptom at the moment with, influencers or people that are sponsored by one brand will do their product release video. They'll be given the equipment before it's released. They'll ride it. And then they can only really give it context in that brand's ecosystem. Whereas me and Chris ride everything. So you'll get something slightly biased from someone that's been given stuff. But from us, you'll get something that's more objective. And that's what we should be producing as a more neutral body, if you like.
It makes a lot of sense. But are you also, if you do that, those reviews, are you sometimes like scared of giving too honest opinions, scared so that the manufacturers won't send you gear to test anymore?
Not really. I think you're in a position as a magazine where they need you. It gives you more leverage. And also, like, I'm not obviously going to name names, but sometimes someone sends us something and it doesn't work or it's really terrible. Then it's better not to, you know, because normally this is pre-release equipment as well, or there's a fault with it. We'll just feedback and say we don't think this is right. And 9 times out of 10, we're correct, and they'll rectify it. They'll, there's been instances where production's been changed, or they'll go back and try again. So, not that we're an authority. There's this ancient English proverb that opinions are like assholes. So, and that everyone's got one. So, it's just me and Chris are massive assholes, I'd say.
You would rather not air.
It's better to talk to them. And not air it and say, go and change it. Or we think that, and normally they're half aware that something's wrong already.
All right.
What was the foil we tested recently that is a good example of this? What is it called? It's the Reading one. And it's got a name that's something to do with airplanes. Can you remember what it is?
Yeah.
I can't remember. I haven't got my computer. But no, anyway, there was a reading foil that I think Cain DeWilde designed for them. And it's really, really good fun, right? This thing's amazing to ride, like quick, but really technical in its pitch. And you could just see from our riding that, you know, because we got loads of drone footage of it being winged, and Chris had proned it as well. You could see from our riding that it was really twitchy in its pitch control. And then, funnily enough, my wife Sarah went to the read-in meeting, and the whole dealer network were like, yeah, it's a really spicy foil, but it's because it's been designed by Cain DeWilde. Of course, it's going to be quite spicy. It was really fun to ride, but it's technical. And I think we got that across very diplomatically in the video we did, and who it was aimed for. And yeah, it was just very performant foil. It's like you'd tune to it, but it would take you longer to tune to it than something that's easier to ride. So it's all thresholds at the end of the day.
Are these deep dive reviews also part of the foiling magazine, or is that something totally different?
It is part of the foiling magazine, yeah. It's under that mantra. So it's kind of bonus, because obviously we see a lot of online content. Some of it kind of sponsored, some of it not. We felt that we were in a good position to do some as well and sell it kind of as a additional thing for a manufacturer that's advertising.
Mm-hmm. You also have a newsletter, the Friday Pump newsletter.
Yeah. Yeah. That's quite fun, that one. So that again is like almost like curated social media and news content.
Is it like what happened the last week, or how do you organize that? What's the content?
To be honest with you, that's not really my desk. Like, I read it and I'm amused, but I think I've had to cover on it once or something. But yeah, it's just, you just find some interesting things that have tickled you with social media in the last week or so, and then it's curated and put together. And that can be tied in with product releases and things like that.
And speaking about exotic foils, because you mentioned the Flight Lab earlier on the episode, and can you say something more? Because there is a lot of hype around these foils, but a little out.
Sounds like, I don't know, did any of you guys get to the boot or not? Was there anything at the boot?
At the boot, yeah.
Anything
but
there?
I haven't seen them. There's really? So many people there.
Yeah. I think there was about to be something on display at the boat show at Dusseldorf. And from what I've heard, there's going to be something, I think the amp jet is going to be, there's going to be functional ones from about April.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really tell you much much more than that.
But none of you covered the boat show.
Alex normally goes, so he went I think last year. It's difficult because we're in like constant communication with all the brands all the time anyway. So for us, you can go there, you'll see some faces, but you already know everything. It's not like you're a consumer. So the expo things like are a bit, sometimes it's worth it, sometimes it's not. We go to like a lot of the dealer meetings. So if a brand does an annual dealer meeting, we'll go along to that. Interesting though, that's quite a good story for you. So that's when I've, like the first time I tried wing foiling was like literally Robbie Nash on the beach.
Wow.
Giving me the wing and saying, just stand on that board. Because I could suck foil, I could go. So he was quite impressed. And then,
that was 2019. To impress Robbie Nash, that must have been
So there was a little bit of pressure there. And then the second time I wing foiled was a couple of months later in Mauritius with F1. So F1 at that point, flying everyone out to Mauritius for dealer meetings, the good old days. And that was literally like Rafael Sal, here it is, Richie, you're a big guy, see if this works. So he gave me a 6-meter prototype. And off I went. And then when I went back into the dinner hall in the evening, everyone gave me a round of applause, okay? But they didn't know I could already suck, because I was kind of cheating. So that was really embarrassing. But yeah, that was really early doors stuff. You know, like, I think that dealer meeting F1 had in Mauritius was really key for the whole sport, because that was the first time winging looked viable. I think.
It looked stupid for a long time.
They were turning into Manawa, you know, nice, big, soft, rumbly wave. And it just looked fun. It just looked glidy and fun. And that's what made the penny drop for me. Like the Nash thing in the May, it was earlier in the year, so it's like May versus August. The Nash thing in May didn't really look that viable still. But yeah, after Mauritius, I came back and I was just like, right, I need to get it all now and get it organized, which was good.
How long did it take until people in your area started winging as well? Did you have to show them? Like, this
it's
is actually
a bit
dumb.
It's a bit of a funny little microclimate here in that I'm here and I've usually got equipment in advance of everyone else. So people saw it and they were like, you're not doing that. They were really dismissive. Like, oh, why are you doing that? And I was like, no, I've seen this work. I've seen it. And to start with, it was pretty terrible. You know, it was high volume boards pottering around up and down. You could go next to a kite foiler. It looked bloody terrible. And then 6 months later, the people are watching me in waves, and then they're like, right, we need to do this. And that's, again, why my kind of retail side took off so well, because I was early, because I'd had that advantage, I'd had that inside knowledge. But it's all, you know, it's all leveled out now. Like, my riding ability is, like, fair, you know, it's all right, it's fairly good. But a lot of people have caught up with me now. Like Chris, for instance, you know, that I do the deep dive with, he was probably a year and a half, 2 years behind me starting to wing foil, and now he's better than me by a stretch. So, yeah, it's amazing how it's all leveled out and very quickly.
Yeah. Well, I've listened to two other podcasts, the one that you were on as well, and I'm interested because you try so many different gear. And there on the show as well, you talked about gong. I was at the boat. I talked to a couple of different people, and the topic gong is always there. And people say, well, they did like cheaper stuff for people who just started, but now they're getting better. But some say, well, that's not going to last. Do you have an opinion on that?
It's been interesting to see that evolution along. There's always like direct to market stuff with water sports. I mean, we don't really see, I think Brexit kind of killed it a bit in the UK. So, because all of a sudden people were having to pay quite a lot of tax to get it in, and the after sales was more tricky if they were trying to send things back. From a repairs perspective, I see rather a lot of them, or I used to see rather a lot of them, like early days winging. And there was definitely some manufacturing stuff that wasn't brilliant. But now, like, you know, you see them, particularly in competition, I think they've done a great job. And so, and I think some of the foils are really good, but it's difficult to know. I've said this before, but it's like they seem to kind of imitate things rather than develop things ground up a little bit, I think. So perhaps they're not taking the risk in the R&D, but I think even that's evolving. It's like you look at their Power Wing range, and it's probably the most comprehensive on the market straight away.
Everything is still theoretical, right? There's no prices yet, there's nothing real yet. So
I mean, something like that, I think they've got as much validity as any other brand, but maybe the manufacturing, and you know, things are normally cheap for a reason, not just delayering the kind of distribution process. And I'd rather reward a brand that's been really innovative, and that's how I feel about it.
All right, there's so many producers of foils and gear in general. Do you think in the near future that is going to change? Brands are going to die?
Yeah.
All right.
You're trying to lead me in there.
No, it's fine.
I think it's funny. I've seen this with kite surfing as well, in that, there's people with big dreams and big aspirations of having their own brand and stuff, and then the money gets tight, and then it kind of, it's all very cyclic. It's almost like as one dies, another one will pop up, or they'll be phoenixed, or another round of investment will come through and it will bounce back. So, you just never, it's a very organic industry in that sense.
It's still pretty young.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of it is based on the wind sports industry. So, like, if you look at Duotain, they're a major player. it's interesting with duotone. I think it's taken them a little while to dial everything in. I think this year is the first year I'd say, like, I'd happily ride their product almost. Like, the foil's now good. The wing's now really good. Like, but last year I'd have been like, maybe not. So, yeah.
At the boat, people, when I talked about duotone, people said, well, yeah, they're fine. They're boring. But maybe that's what keeps them alive longer.
I think it's a very stable brand, isn't it? And they, you know, their kite range is good. But obviously they've had, like, Ralph Brozel's left, and now he's got this Brainchild factory. So I've had samples from that. They did some custom wings for us, and that they're really, really good as well. So there's some competition there.
They must be good at the pump foil event, the pump foil race that took place. The guy, Benjamin, who won, he rode duotone. So,
yeah.
Probably not
No. Like, that, I mean, you put a good rider on anything, it'll look good. So
That is true. Yeah. So let's come back a little bit to your magazine. I saw that you can buy 4 of these issues for $80 a year.
Yeah.
And you can also have the online the online magazine for $15. Do you think it is nice to have the paper one? Is it just like personal thing? Something you read on your toilet, except if you're not going on Instagram, you have the actual piece of paper. How would you market that?
There's something about, like, I try and spend as little time on screen as possible, personally. Like, I'm kind of done with computers and fans and things, or I try and minimize it to work. You know, I don't really go on social media for pleasure as such, which some people do. So, like, yeah, from my perspective, I'd always rather have the printed one. And there's something about the way it's delivered. Like, I think if you do something online and you make an error, you can correct it. Whereas if it's printed, it's printed, and that makes you very careful when you write something. I'd say it's a bit old school, but people like it, and you have to be realistic about the age of the market as well. I'd say, you know, the realistic market, you know, from our statistics is a 35 to 45, 50 year old male. That's your market. And that's kind of almost pre, they can still read. So they don't need to be spoon fed video the whole time.
Yeah. Did you have any problems during COVID, or did that actually, people who were at home, they read a little more? Did that maybe even help?
It boosted things, if anything. Loads of people took up subscriptions during COVID because they had nothing else to do. So, like, you know, like the whole of the water sports industry, really, there was a massive spike.
And is it hard to, now after that, is it hard to stay alive as a printed magazine? Because I imagine costs are high.
Not really, is what I'd say.
Nice.
Like, with the combination of, you know, there's me working on it, there's Kai working on it full time. You have to look at it as more of a holistic thing than just a printed magazine, because you've got all the online stuff, you've got the mail drops, you've got the social media. It's much, much more. It's kind of borderline. Well, it is kind of marketing agency rather than printed magazine. It's bigger. And when you actually look at the time allocation of putting the magazine together, there's almost as much time spent on everything around that and the releases. We print it in Estonia with recycled paper. Obviously, we tried to do it as kind of nicely as possible. You know, it's printed in Estonia with recycled paper. It's eco ink. It's we're trying to make a nice product at the end of the day.
It looks very nice.
And people,
it looks very nice.
People
very
buy it.
Quality product. You probably still have to say innovative. Is there anything you tried and then it didn't work out and you had to take it out again? Or was it always like, no, we're staying the same, we try to go as conservative as necessary?
It just keeps getting bigger. I don't know how many pages it is at the moment. It's probably over 200. The first one started kind of, you know, 150, and then it went really fat during the pandemic, and then maybe it's gone back a little bit. But from a features point of view, there's kind of set features we do. like the technical articles, the reviews end. The reviews end will expand and contract depending on releases. So it depends who's got what when. But it normally evens out at like maybe like 20 reviews magazine. But yeah, we just it constantly evolves, and if we think something's relevant, we'll keep it, and if we don't think it's relevant, we'll pull it. So yeah.
And with you, how many people are writing reviews and other articles in their
reviews wise? I think there's like eight or ten of us just dotted around the globe. Often like it's complementary skill sets. So with downwinding coming up, for instance, and people sort of demanding reviews on downwind stuff, like that's something that I've had the equipment for and tried here quite a lot, but it doesn't really work. Like it's one of those things that doesn't quite work in this location. So yeah, we got like Steve on Maui, and we used John Mann a bit as well in Holland before he became a bit more sponsored. So he was great. On like downwind reviews. So that's you just got to kind of send the kit to whoever's most qualified to test it and who's got the skill set. So I generally stick to wing and SCP. With this Powerwing thing, I might end up doing a bit of that as well. I had a play with the Roger the other day.
You tried the
just
Roger?
In my driveway. Yeah, I've had a game with the Roger, but just up and down my driveway.
How do you like it?
Yeah, it seems simple. I'm still like not 100% sold on the concept in this location. I can see where it would work. But basically we have like a small sandy bay, and then we have, you know, it can be like 10 miles of cliff, like really steep, you know, 100 meters cliff, then another sandy bay. And in between there's loads of, you know, it's just rocks and instant death. So it's not an, it's like, James Casey came over in the summer and he hit like the best conditions ever, like which only happens about four times a year. And he thinks it's amazing here, but the majority of the time it would be impossible for me to test downwind. But you know, I'll try. If I end up at Hood River next year, I'll give it a go again, I think, today.
Very nice. So that's next with you. Is there anything for the magazine that you're about to change, try out new things, add things, anything?
We've had a bit of a break from deep dive just because of personal stuff. So Chris is really busy with his house at the moment. So he's doing up a house. And to be honest with you, we got to the end of the season and we just felt we needed a bit of a break from it. So we run this Curno foil competition every year. So Curno Foil Classic, which is, yeah, it's a pretty significant competition now. It's in its second year and it's a pure surf competition. So we had like Jack Ho fly over this year and stuff like that. Had some, yeah, it's been really, really cool. And by the end of that, we were just like, we just need to not talk about foiling for about until Christmas, and then we'll work it out from there, because we're both feeling like, because for both of us, it's you know, it's our work, living, everything. We just need to turn off for a bit and get a fresh perspective.
Does that work? Does that usually work?
Yeah. I feel much more motivated now, actually. I've still been riding, obviously, but I needed to ride for pure fun for a bit, I'd say, to balance it. Yeah. But yeah, I went to Fuerteventura for a week as well, and that rewrited my center.
Where'd you go?
Just to Fuerteventura.
Yeah. We had Gunnar Vinjas and Fuerte Julia on the show, Corralejo. Did you stay up there as well?
Corralejo. Where was I?
Like the north or the south?
I was in Lajares, and then we were, I can never pronounce this right because I'm English, but we were basically start foiling at Machinico. I don't know how to say that. The little bay in the north, like straight out of Lajares. Is that nice. Julia Castro?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I met her before once.
Cool.
And right. Gunnar, I like, my kid went up to him because he had the same mystic fluffy thing. They were having a talk.
He probably, kite falling as long as you have, probably.
Yeah. He's done loads of testing in R&D stuff as well. He's done loads of that sort of thing. Yeah, I had a chat with him at Lajas a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Very nice. If you missed that episode.
Small industry, very, very small industry.
Gunnar's episode is either going to be up here or there or wherever. So if you haven't listened to that one, you can check that out again. God, I'm actually done with my list. God, do you have anything else you want to ask Rich?
No, that's awesome. Just some unbiased opinion in regards to the pairing, because you said that it's not gonna, like, for example, it's not working in every condition, but do you see it as something is gonna grow? Or
the thing is, I know the future. This is the problem. So I think there's going to be some stuff that's kind of in between a power wing and a kite, and there's going to be other products that will maybe kind of simplify things a little bit. But I can't tell you about that because I've signed NDAs. So yeah, I think there's going to be a whole spectrum of towing craft, is what I'd say. Or, you know, like small wingy thingies.
All right.
That make things simpler and make things more efficient.
It's exciting. Yeah. Exciting times, I think. Really cool. And as you said, instant.
Yeah, this is the thing. It all proliferates so fast. It's like, you know, how long have we seen power wings for? Maybe 6 months in kind of a commercial context. But very few of us have actually had a go. But the Roger felt really nice. It just felt like a simple kite, like a fling on the beach when I was a kid.
It's super great. Easy, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's some issues, maybe though. You can make it simpler. Yeah, you can make it more simple. Yeah, yeah. I saw the string that worries me. If I'm like 2 miles out to sea and then I manage to wrap that bridle around my foil or something, that'd be a disaster, wouldn't it?
I did that, actually.
Okay.
It took some time to get it. I wanted to take it down, and I like was too much on my back, and my board went just through the bridles, and then it wrapped around my foils. So it took some time to get it out. It was the only time I let go of the bar to untangle everything. But after a couple of minutes, it was fine.
Where were you testing it?
I was on the Lake Neuchâtel, which is the lake here in Switzerland where people actually do most downwinders. Have you seen it?
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, I've been to Neuchâtel before.
It was a little bit too much with 25 to 35 knots. So I think a little bit too much for the 4 meter. And had a too big board over foiled, but it was still a lot easier than with the paddles, which I'm still struggling with.
Yeah. It's funny with downwinding here because it, like, unless the conditions are absolutely perfect. So when I first started training it, I'd basically get on the downwind board. I'd paddle out to sea for like 15, 20 minutes and then turn around, and I could pop up. You know, if you take a big enough board and foil, you're always going to pop up if you've got that sub-foil experience. And then I'd ride back, you know, in probably 2 minutes. And I'd get back to the beach, and then I'd be riding a big foil, so it wasn't necessarily that pleasurable. And then I'd just think to myself, why didn't I just go winging?
I had the exact same problem. You have a beautiful day for winging, and then, no, I'm going to take the paddle. Well, takes 1.5 hours, and not the 5 minutes that it would take. So,
yeah, I've got too many jobs, like a young family. And what has been really good for me is foil drive. So it's funny with that one. So that turned up a year ago, maybe. I had one on pre-release on the magazine. And I tried it, and I knew it was going to be, that was something I knew straight away was going to be massive. I was like, it's too accessible, too easy, and just way too much fun too quickly. I have this real sort of mixed, ethical stance on it, because it's, you know, I'm spoiled by really good surf conditions here in a pretty big surf community as well. So it's one of those things that's a little bit controversial, I'd say, around here. But yeah, that thing. Like, if you're a busy guy and you've got an hour at lunchtime or something to go and have a session before you go back to work, that thing's incredible, because you can go out, get 20 waves, maybe even more in an hour, come back. It's just so convenient, comparatively.
Dominic was on the show. Dominic from Foil Drive Europe was on the boat, and he showed it around in this big pool they had. And he fell down a couple of times, but that was part of the deal because he wanted to show how to get back on foil. I'm lucky that in Switzerland, you're not allowed to use foil drive. So it's good for my wallet. So
that's really good for your fitness as well. I've been on the foil drive diet a little bit since Christmas. I definitely need to see some paddling again. But it's really nice, like, for testing foils in a hurry as well. That's really good. And it was really interesting the other day. So I use like an Armstrong 880 with it. So the HA. And I was like, you know, I've got all those MA ones hanging around. What would the MA be like? And it was really good to like verify what I thought about the MA's low end, because all of a sudden I was like, 1,000 MA is probably the equivalent lift to an 880. But it was so much faster and looser. So it's really good for like comparative testing quickly. You know, you go back, you flip the front wing on, and off you go. And those guys have got so much stuff in the pipeline, you know, that's going to make things even more, you know, really extend the scope of it. And I've been taking that out in pretty consequential ways as well. So it's kind of, you know, eliminated any desire I ever had to get a jet ski and do towing around it, because it's more convenient. And,
go by yourself. Nice.
Me and my friend James had it out in probably overhead and a half to double overhead. And with some of the new bits they're going to release, like I could be riding a 680 foil and just like screaming. It's so much. And the inset boards as well, they make a huge difference. So like that's kind of the most, because I think winging's leveled to an extent. And from a magazine and like how the sport's progressing point of view, like the whole lithium thing is definitely going to be a thing in a big market sector. I think prices will come down, the equipment will get better. Yeah, it's a hell of a product.
Well, Rich, thank you very much. Is there anything you want to add, you want to talk about?
Not really. I'd like to know a bit more about you guys, really. Go. I don't know. What do you do?
I pump foil mainly because I'm not into wing foiling.
Mainly pump
and
foiling.
Here I have not like good conditions to downwinds or to surf, which is actually my main goal. I would love to prom foil a bit more. But I've got a foil drive and I'm having fun with this.
Okay, come to the UK, honestly.
Yeah. I will.
It's a good pump training tool, that, because you got to pump the battery. Then you get, I always find with foil drive, you get back on your normal board, even going back onto an SUP, and it feels like, it feels so much nicer. You know, you pump and you're like, wow, I'm really shooting forward. You're not controlling all that mass. It's great.
100%.
All right. Well, then we're going to wrap it up. I'm going to tell you who's the next guest. It's going to be next episode. Let me double check that I take the right one. Oh no, I lost my sheet. Here, we have the next one. Next one, next episode. Oh, nice. It's going to be with Jan Putz. Jan Putz is a foil designer, and he's with Enzis, and he designs foils. He designed the foil that I used last weekend, a new stabilizer, which makes it super easy to find that sweet spot when you're just colliding. So you're super quickly on that perfect pitch to smoothly foil down, and he explains how that works, how he designs foils, and what he does for a living. So really cool, looking forward to that.
That sounds good. Nice lesson in hydrodynamics for you.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much, Rich, for coming on the show. For
no
the
worries.
Listeners, we're on YouTube as well. For the viewers, you can just listen to it on the go on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast.
Yeah, listen to it. You don't need to see my face for an hour. Like,
we're going to add super cool B-roll. So if you're just listening to it, check out YouTube as well. So see you in the next one.
See you in the next one. Bye.
Bye-bye.